Welcome to another episode of Inside Umami Medicine Podcast. Today I'm joined by the amazing Dr. Mikhail Sekeres, the Chief of the Division of Hematology Oncology at the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center in the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. This is the second part of our podcast. During the first part, we concentrated on the storytelling, the humanitarian aspect of Dr. Sekeres's practice, how he is able to connect with his patients in a very, very insightful and meaningful way. And in the process, we found that he brought hope, he brought comfort, and was able to help many of them achieve their goals when he could not actually help them overcome their disease. Having said that, he also has a lot more successes than he had disappointments in that context in terms of trying to save people's lives with blood cancers. So we are now going to focus on the different treatment modalities that he has within his armamentarium to help patients who present with hematologic malignancies or blood cancers in general. We know you're a leukemia specialist. Tell us a little bit about the current landscape when it comes to those types of malignancies.
Actually, I think the landscape for treatment is really exciting. I specialize in acute myeloid leukemia, particularly in older adults, and another cancer of the blood and bone marrow called myelodysplastic syndromes. Both of these typically affect people at around the age of 70. So a lot of people often think that acute leukemia is something that affects children. That is true with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, ALL, but actually ALL even itself has a second peak in older adults, and acute myeloid leukemia, and as I mentioned, myelodysplastic syndromes is really a cancer of older adults. And what we've seen over the past few decades, and you've seen this also, you're a basic scientist, Dean Ford, or translational scientist, are the fruits of decades of funding for basic and translational cancer research at understanding the biology of these diseases. And one of the real explosions in the past decade and a half has been understanding the genetics of leukemias and myelodysplastic syndromes. We talked during the first section about narratives and storytelling. And I think of science as storytelling as well. And I start with the story of a patient. So I've really focused my career on trying to tell that story and understand that story from a scientific perspective. I'll give you an example. A patient comes to me with leukemia. What are some of the risk factors that led to that development of leukemia? What are some of the prognostic factors that will predict how well a patient will do with a specific type of therapy or with any type of therapy? What are the drugs that we can explore in clinical trials that could allow that person to live longer or to live better? Those are the two kind of endpoints FDA thinks about, lives longer, lives better. What are some of the translational aspects of that person's diagnosis? So what are some of the genetic mutations that have contributed to that diagnosis, and where do they start and how do they evolve over time? What's that person's quality of life as he or she is going through treatment, and how does that person make decisions about treatment? And then even thinking about quality and delivery of care and how do we study that? So I start with a story of a patient, and I guess I could be criticized for having a career in research that's focused on a lot of different areas, but one disease. And that's something that one of my mentors, Stephanie Lee, who's a bone marrow transplant specialist, when I was in training, she said to me, you need to figure out, do you want to focus your career on a methodology? So do you want to focus on one specific type of research, or do you want to focus on a disease? And that was some of the best advice I received. And I decided early on, I wanted to focus on a disease. That led to a lot of different methodologies and a lot of different ways of exploring the science. And I think it's actually led to better treatments for my patients so that they are living longer and are living better.
That's great to hear. So why did you choose the particular disease that you chose?
So I chose hematology oncology because of something that happened during my intern year. I did my internship and residencies, as I mentioned before, at Mass General in Boston. And my very first month, I was placed in the intensive care unit. And I had never been in an ICU during med school. I did no ICU rotation. So I might have gone and consulted on one or two patients, but I didn't live, eat, and breathe there like you do when you're actually in the ICU. And one night, a woman was admitted to the ICU. She was actually a pediatric doctor in Boston. She was in her early 40s, and she had metastatic ovarian cancer. It was this awful, awful story, and she was the most delightful person you could imagine. And she was brought to the intensive care unit because her lungs were filling up with fluid from ovarian cancer that had metastasized there, and she was about to be placed on a respirator. But she decided she didn't want that. She decided she was ready to die, and she didn't want to spend her last hours on Earth on a breathing machine. So, of course, we honored that, and as evening began to fall, her husband came in with her two children, aged 8 and 10, and it was so she could say goodbye. Ripped our hearts out of our chest. It was so moving and emotional. And they left, and then her husband came back with her best friend, and they were carrying CVS bags. And they went into her room, and I saw that. All night I was running around getting vitals and I's and O's and doing everything for my junior resident. I was an intern. And kind of saw her at her bed with her husband or her best friend holding a clipboard up, and she was writing. So I went into my junior resident, who represented truth to me, and said to him, what's going on in that room? And he said, well, she's writing up cards. I didn't understand at first what he meant. I had a pocket full of 3x5 cards that we carried around on every patient, right? I thought he meant a 3x5 card. And he said, no, she's writing out birthday cards, bar and bat mitzvah cards, holiday cards. She was writing cards to her children for the next 10 years of their lives so that every occasion she could be with them in just a little bit of a way. And she could probably, in that time as she's writing those cards, think about what her kids were going to go through in those next 10 years. So I came out of that night. I originally was going to be a cardiologist, and actually came out of that night thinking, you know what? I want to focus on oncology. I want to have even a glancing relationship with people who are like this and who are so inspiring. So I kind of ran with that. And then when I was in my fellowship, my very first rotation again was with a leukemia specialist. And I realized that his name is Rich Stone. He's still at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And he practiced medicine the way I wanted to practice medicine, and had these very close relationships with his patients, and did incredible clinical research that has actually led to FDA approval of drugs. He has literally changed the lives of people with leukemia.
Fantastic. So why is it important for patients with leukemias and essentially cancer of the blood and bone marrow to be treated in a NCI-designated cancer center?
So it's a great question. One of the areas of research that we've done, we actually published this pretty recently, was part of a study that's being conducted through the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. This is a multi-million dollar study where we're looking at the natural history of people who have myelodysplastic syndromes. And we're enrolling them onto this trial at the very moment a diagnosis is suspected. So they haven't even had their first bone marrow biopsy. They undergo a bone marrow biopsy at their local center. That could be anywhere in the U.S. The study is open at 150 sites around the U.S. And their local pathologist makes a diagnosis. We then have expert pathologists who are located centrally as part of the study who review those bone marrow slides, and they make a diagnosis. And we noticed that there were discrepancies in those two diagnoses. And when we really dug down into the data, we realized that about 20% of the time, so for 1 out of 5 patients, they were receiving the wrong diagnosis at their local site. Wow. And not subtleties in diagnosis that eggheads like me think about a lot, right? So it's not some subtlety of a myelodysplastic syndrome subtype where they may or may not have ring sideroblasts, and in the end, who really cares but us? But they were differences in diagnoses where a local pathologist said, you have a vitamin deficiency, and our central pathologist said, no, they don't, they've got leukemia.
That's such an important point. What How would someone like that present normally that would lead to the diagnosis of vitamin deficiency as opposed to the vitamin? So let's suppose I'm Joe Blow and then I come to see my doctor, and what is it that I would be complaining about that would lead to that diagnosis? And then in the cancer center, that's in the NCI designated cancer center, we get something completely different. The presentation and just tell us, give us a little flavor for it.
So first of all, you would always be Dean Joe Blow. So someone may go to a doctor because he or she isn't feeling well. That doctor gets blood tests. The blood tests are abnormal. Someone may jump down a line of thinking, oh my God, this is leukemia. We need a bone marrow biopsy. They get a bone marrow biopsy on that patient. They say to the pathologist, I think this patient has leukemia. Their blood counts are terrible. They look like they're suffering. The pathologist looks at the sample and may think that he or she sees a lot of blasts. But a lot of that, if you're going to take a Bayesian approach to this, their pretest probability was greatly altered by the information they were fed. So going into it, they may overcall something and say it's leukemia, when actually vitamin deficiencies can mimic leukemia or myelodysplastic syndromes. So that's one of those aspects of diagnosis that we always teach trainees. You have to send vitamin studies, thyroid studies. Sometimes you have to send levels of metals to make sure that one of these isn't mimicking myelodysplastic syndrome or leukemia. And that actually happened recently to me. There was a patient who was diagnosed with leukemia at an outside hospital. The reports came through, said that this person had 30% blasts in the bone marrow. Blasts are immature white blood cells. Once you have 20% blasts, we say you have acute leukemia. He came to me, but there was something that didn't quite smell right about it. He was sick, but not that sick. And his blood counts were abnormal, but not that abnormal from what we usually see. So we repeated everything, had our pathologist here at Sylvester and University of Miami, who are experts at blood and bone marrow cancers, look at the specimens, and they said, this is a vitamin deficiency, this isn't leukemia. So it's really critical, and I would say this to anybody, particularly with rare diagnoses like hematologic malignancies, it's always worth getting a second opinion, not just for the treatment to receive, but also the diagnosis itself. And when we followed through on our study from the NHLBI, we actually circled back and looked at all these folks who had discrepant diagnoses between their local pathologist and our central pathologist. And three of us sat down and looked at how they were treated locally compared to how we would have treated them based on the central diagnosis. And 7% of the time, they were given the wrong treatment. So it is so, so important, particularly with rare diagnoses, to go to a center of excellence like we have here.
And in fact, as we know, NCI designated cancer centers, such as the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center, it offers a certain breadth, the depth of scope and quality of research that is simply not available in most other places, most other cancer centers for that matter. So tell us a little bit about what's going on right now in research arenas, especially in myelodysplastic syndromes and or anything else that you want to highlight for us.
No, we have so much going on. It's almost hard to narrow this to something that would fit into a podcast. So I think we're going to need a third and fourth segment. So I talked earlier, I'll give you a great example. I talked earlier about the genetics of leukemia and myelodysplastic syndromes and these decades of research in basic and translational science that have led us to understand the biology of these diseases so we can capitalize on that biology and develop treatments that target it. One great example of this, the chief of our leukemia section is Justin Watts, and he led investigation into a drug called olutasidenib and that targets IDH mutations in leukemia and demonstrated
that. So for the uninitiated, tell the audience what IDH mutation is all.
So they work through pyruvate pathways and touch on methylation as well. And you know, the whole story of methylation in cancer is that methyl groups presumably silence tumor suppressor genes, right? So if you can eliminate the methyl groups, you have tumor suppressor genes actually working and suppressing the tumor like they're supposed to. So and IDH mutations are also involved in proliferation of these cancers. So
so the methylation allows the tumor to evade all of the potential inherent ability of the host to stop that tumor from propagating. So,
exactly, right? You can almost argue that cancer is an inherent immune deficiency disorder because our immune system failed to eliminate the cancer, right? It's obviously a radical view of cancer, but not so radical with some of the treatments we've developed. So he led the clinical trials of this drug that showed that it worked in 40 to 60% of patients. They were able to actually get remissions and go, you know, on average over between half a year and a year on this drug alone. That's long enough for a lot of these patients to actually make it to a bone marrow transplant, which really is the curative therapy for leukemia. So we've been involved in some of the clinical research that's led to the FDA approval of drugs for leukemias and myelodysplastic syndromes. And I like to think about clinical research from the benefit of our patients looking at the benefit. One of my patients, actually, I saw yesterday, we enrolled on a clinical trial, and it looks like his blood counts are starting to improve, so something's working. And he said to me, you know, I hope this works for two reasons. I hope it works for me, and I hope it that you're looking at this drug in me is going to help future generations of patients. So people think about it from a personal benefit, but also from altruism, from helping, you know, the greater cancer community. And we're able to do that here. And I like to think of these trials as offering patients clinical trials, so experimental treatment today that has a chance of becoming the standards of tomorrow. So our patients, and I have a bunch of patients I've treated where they've gotten drugs years before they were actually approved by the FDA because they participated in clinical trials.
And that's wonderful. Now, let's suppose the clinical trial is successful. I'm now in remission. Life is good. Carrying out my business. But then suddenly I start feeling poorly again, and then you diagnose essentially a relapse. Is there any hope for me?
Yeah.
Or do I just go take care of my priorities? Like my coach would say, what's important to me?
What are your goals?
You're right on my goals.
So absolutely there's hope. We see patients when they're initially diagnosed. We build up these very close relationships, and we have strict monitoring protocols in place so that we can detect cancer returning as soon as it returns. And we follow patients, as I mentioned, with leukemia for 5 years. We have a good shot of getting folks into remission the very beginning when we treat them for leukemia. We have a decent shot of curing them with some of the treatments that we have. If the leukemia comes back, we have go-to standards that we use for treating patients who are relapsed. Once someone has relapsed with leukemia, their only chance of being cured is a bone marrow transplant. So our goal is to get those folks to a bone marrow transplant as soon as possible. We work hand in hand with our transplant colleagues so that we coordinate that care. And as I mentioned, we have a ton of clinical trials that we can offer folks when the standards of care fall short. And one of the things I like to tell people, I had to say this to my own mom, actually, right? Your ultimate, we talked in the first segment about how our children are our truth test. Your real truth test is your mother, right? So my mother once said to me, I never want to be a guinea pig. I never want to participate in a clinical trial. And I said, you're saying this to me. I'm a clinical trialist. I built my career around this. What a lot of people don't understand is they're not guinea pigs on clinical trials. At the very least, they're receiving the standard of care. And often they're receiving better than the standard of care and certainly closer surveillance often than they would receive if they weren't on a clinical
trial. We also hear a lot about, we talked about bone marrow transplant as the ultimate and deferred treatment. We also hear about immunotherapy and CAR T cells and so forth. Are they applicable here?
So immunotherapy has been one of these great revolutions in the treatment of cancer over the past decade. And there are select cancers where it really has been just a superstar, particularly in patients who have lymphomas, patients with melanomas, patients with lung cancer. For the cancers that I treat, immunotherapy hasn't quite come of age, although we have a lot of clinical trials looking at it. And we ourselves are participating in approaches to patients that include things like checkpoint inhibitors, which is a type of immunotherapy, CAR T cell therapy. One of the centers in the country was the first to enroll patients onto CAR T cell clinical trials before they became approved, and bone marrow transplant, which is the ultimate immunotherapy. We're transplanting somebody else's immune system, of course.
Indeed. Yeah. Good. For some patients, you have a special cocktail, and I call it a special drug regimen that you use. Tell us a little bit about that, and why a four-drug regimen as opposed to anything else to try to deal with the more vexing or challenging or recalcitrant cancers.
Yeah. One of the things we noticed in developing these drugs that target these genetic mutations is that with rare exceptions, they don't tend to work alone. The rare exception to that.
Why is that? It's a good thing. I think it's one of the basic tenets of oncology, but it would be great for the audience to hear that.
So yeah, this is a common misperception. My dad, who is a journalist, once said to me, why can't we cure cancer? Why can't you come up with a drug that'll cure cancer? As if cancer is one diagnosis, right? And we face this in healthcare all the time. It should be easy. Cancer is thousands and thousands and thousands of diagnoses, and every single one of them is typified by different genetic mutations that led to the cancer. You know, we started out with the Knudsen two-hit hypothesis, remember, with colon cancer, where it was kind of revolutionary at the time, where Knudsen said, no, it's not one thing that has to go wrong, it's two things that have to go wrong to actually cause cancer. What we found in myelodysplastic syndromes and acute myeloid leukemia, it's not two things that go wrong. It's, on average, four driver mutations, and it might be a total of 9, 12, 13 mutations in total that these folks have on average. So we think about the evolution of these cancers that actually may occur for myelodysplastic syndrome, certainly over decades. So when we use a targeted agent, let's say it targets an IDH1 mutation, right? That's great if a person has an IDH1 mutation, but you have to ask the question, if that IDH1 mutation was the third or fourth mutation, what are you going to do with the first two or three?
Sure.
And they're then going to evolve either down the same pathway or a different pathway entirely that we're going to wind up treating a different type of leukemia. Some of the work that we did also has looked at, in looking at the genetics of these mutations, we've realized that patients who present with a myelodysplastic syndrome or leukemia in their 60s or 70s may have a congenital mutation. So six, seven, eight decades earlier, they were born with a mutation. And one in particular that we discovered was the DDX41 mutation, a dead box helicase. And it remains quiescent for years until they get that second hit. And that second mutation might have been brought along by, let's say it's radiation therapy for breast cancer, right? Or it might have been brought along by smoking for 3 decades or some other insult. And that second mutation that predisposes them to the third and finally the fourth that leads to the clinical manifestation of the cancer.
So, in other words, if we're going to tackle this problem, we have multiple areas where we may have to intervene. So that's why you have to have multiple potential. We have a four-drug cocktail. And how do we get there? First of all, how do we select? And how do we make sure that this particular regimen is going to work? I understand the pathophysiology, the underlying mechanism, and so forth. But there's no guarantee that anything's going to work. And that brings us to clinical trials. And tell us a little bit about that and how you go through the selection process. What are the possibilities that one particular drug will be successful and so on? Because obviously, you know, for the uninitiated, it looks like it's a shot in the dark.
So it's a really great perspective. And I've said things similarly, which can be a little controversial, right? We almost become nihilistic about our approach because we recognize that targeting this one mutation is great and may raise the bar of success a little bit, but it's not going to be absolutely transformative unless you have a cancer that has a single mutation that caused it. And that cancer, in what I do, is chronic myeloid leukemia, which is the greatest success story, I think, in oncology that we've had in the past few decades. The reason is that it's a one-hit wonder. There's one mutation that occurs, the BCR-ABL mutation, the 922 translocation, and we actually have targeted drugs. They work really well. There are no other mutations we often have to worry about. Patients go into remission, and they now have normal lifespans.
But you're a hero.
And you're a hero, right? You're a hero for prescribing a pill. But there are vanishingly few numbers of cancers where there's that one mutation. So you wind up becoming nihilistic about it. You say, okay, I'm going to use this drug that targets a mutation, but I'm going to have to do it with the dumb cytotoxic chemotherapy that's going to kill a bunch of different cells because we don't have targeted drugs for all nine of those mutations that have occurred.
Not enough precision.
So one approach that we're taking here at Sylvester and the University of Miami is to try to identify these patients when they have the first mutation. A lot of those patients have a diagnosis we now call clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential, where they may have gone to a doctor, may have had a low blood count. The doctor thought, oh, you have myelodysplastic syndrome or leukemia, did a bone marrow, sent a bunch of genetic tests, and then their blood count actually corrects itself. So it was low for some other reason. But it turns out they do have a mutation. So we follow these folks now in clinic at their very first mutation, and clinical trials are starting where we're actually offering these folks some therapy to try to prevent that mutation from acquiring additional mutations and eventually leukemia. So we think that may be the answer. We hope it will be.
Well, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. And the only place you can do something like that, I would say, is in a NCI designated comprehensive cancer center.
It's only at a place like this. And our we call it a CHIP clinic, is run by Dr. Namrata Chandok. She's built it up herself, and she's following these folks over time to see what really happens to them and introducing clinical trials. The other thing we've recognized with these patients is they're at higher risk not only for leukemias, but also for heart disease. And having one of these mutations may be more predictive of heart disease than a high cholesterol level. So we're also introducing these folks to high-risk cardiology clinics to get them holistic care for everything that may happen.
Now, just to close out the discussion, you conducted a clinical trial. Everything seems to be good. There seems to be an improvement in remission, or should we be measuring, first of all, survival or disease-free survival? And how do we get this drug to become the standard therapy? How do we get the FDA to make sure this is accessible to everybody else?
It's a great question, and it's a far-seeing question. One of the hats I've worn over time was a member and chair of the Oncologic Drugs Advisory Committee of the FDA. And that's the committee, if you're reading the newspapers, and the newspaper says an advisory committee recommended approval of this drug for cancer, that was our committee. So we've actually been working with the FDA on clinical trial endpoints. It's a terrible thing if you have a clinical trial, let's say it's an endpoint that's disease-free survival or progression-free survival or duration of remission, and this drug arrives at the FDA and the FDA says, that's not the endpoint we're looking for. So we're partnering with the FDA, and we've had a number of publications over the past couple of years and white papers that have focused on what are the trial endpoints that the FDA will give a green light to approving a drug. So we're starting at the very first trial to put a drug on the path towards approval if it's safe and effective enough.
Fantastic. Well, without question, Dr. Sekris, you're bringing hope to a group of individuals, of patients who otherwise would be completely desperate. And it's great to see the transformative impact of your work on their lives, and certainly on our community in South Florida. So we're fortunate to have you. We're fortunate to have you not only as the head of the Hematology and Oncology Division, but also as a member of the faculty who brings such a refreshing approach to patient care delivery and such a great storyteller. So it's been fantastic to talk to you for the past two episodes of Inside UMiami Medicine podcast. And I sincerely hope that you'll agree to come back because clearly there's a whole lot more for us to dissect. You yourself alluded to the fact that maybe we need three or four sessions. So yes, it's just been fantastic. So thank you so much for being here.
Well, I want to say I'm so fortunate to be here at the University of Miami and at Sylvester. Thank you for taking me on. And I always say it's my patients who give me hope, too.
Well, thank you so very much. And this has been another episode of Inside Your Miami Medicine Podcast with the incredible Dr. Mikhail Sebers.